Buddhist Summer School, Tuesday afternoon, 30th of August, 1977. You may recall that on Saturday morning we saw that if we had full conception of the Aryan silence. The Aryan silence could include the entire Buddha Dhamma. You may remember we started off with the Buddha's statement that when you are gathered together in conclave, then one of two things ought to be done. Either let the talk be about Dhamma and not any worldly or frivolous subject, either that or the Aryan silence. And we also saw on Tuesday morning that in the course of the discipline which leads to the Aryan silence, talk on Dhamma also leads to that silence, for the simple reason that all talk ceases when one is in what is called the second jhana. It ceases not in the sense of exclusion, but the activity of the psyche has begun to merge into the whole and complete activity of mind in itself, which of course is eternally silent. So that when the aspirant enters that second jhana, talk on Dhamma, that means the teachings, the concepts and so on, are all now merged into the silence as such. And the activity which goes on in the state of the silence of the brain is an activity which is the realization, the experiencing of, if we may so term it, the silent aspects of the Dhamma. And remember, one of the meanings of the word Dhamma derived from Dhri, the upholding of the cosmic order. Now, I have just made a little summary of the two aspects of Dhamma. One which we may call theory or doctrine, the written and spoken doctrine, and that is associated with our what we may call membership of those who take to the Buddha Dhamma. Just membership. And on the other side, we have the practice, not just the theory, but the practice of this Dhamma in our own lives. We bring the Dhamma to life in our own selves. We may call that the realization or actualization of the Dhamma. That is the actualization. And that is discipleship. One can be a follower in the ordinary sense, insofar as one learns the Dhamma by reading or listening or whatever it is. One can learn the Dhamma that way and subscribe to its tenets. But that doesn't make the Dhamma a living thing in our lives. When we ourselves live the Dhamma, then we are beginning to manifest what the Buddha manifested in full and unequivocally declared: who sees me sees the Dhamma. Who sees Dhamma, sees in the profound sense, sees me. You see? It is when one becomes the embodiment of the Dhamma that what he says, what he teaches, has this extraordinary influence which makes the concepts and words which constitute the external form of the Dhamma effective for hundreds of millions of people through the course of centuries. After all, so many of the things that the great religious teachers said, perhaps most of them, could be said by a brainy person, by a perceiving person, but they do not have quite that extraordinary quickening effect. The life within, the spiritual life within, is quickened. Also, set on life. Not set on fire, but set on life. This is what happens. And that is why what the great teachers taught is of such immense power. They uttered the word. They themselves were the living word, and hence that influence and power. That is discipleship in the real sense. That is being, really being the teacher. So now, let us just look at a few points in this connection. The first and second truths, as they are called, the fact of dukkha and its meaning, and the second truth, the cause of dukkha, craving, tanha, the thirst for sentient existence. Existence which wants to feel and experience life and to know it. This is tanha, and it is associated, of course, with all our ordinary natural drives, as we call them, which are our heritage through hundreds of millennia, hundreds of millennia of evolution through by nature, in nature. The organism is derived from some primordial animal ancestor. And all the drives of the animal also exist in our psychophysical organism. But in us there is this extraordinary thing we call religiousness, as no other creature has it. And it is this which is trying to emerge. And the bringing to fruition of this religiousness in our being out of an animal heritage is our specific responsibility and task. Now, because there is this something of extraordinary potency in the human creature, it sets up this peculiar searching for something which is wholly other than, at first, our own limited self. We know that there is something wonderful, something marvelous to which we want to grow, and so forth. And because that is very powerfully enclosed, suppressed through the through what we have derived from our animal ancestry, we are not full good animals, nor are we anywhere near true humans. We are in a halfway house, which is not merely midway, but at all stages from the animal to the perfectly enlightened one. I think it is really quite correct to say that the human race is in the subhuman state. If we were fully animal, then we'd be good animals. We couldn't avoid being good animals because we have no option to be the opposite of good animals. But this peculiar creature, man, has this power of choosing. He can see the opposites. He can see opposites. And therefore, the struggle inside himself arises. And this, because he is unskilled, he hasn't the vision, he hasn't the knowledge and all the rest of it, makes him subhuman. He's neither the one nor the other. The evil we can do, no animal can do. I don't know whether there is any animal which can deliberate evil and exercise it. Does any biologist or Darwinist or anybody know whether there is any animal which can deliberately exercise evil? No. Well, the animal can't, but we can. That is why I think it is fairly correct to say that we are in the subhuman state, and in this subhuman state arises the whole of our dukkha, our own human dukkha, or subhuman dukkha. in which, of course, as the Buddha pointed out, tanha, craving, is the most powerful element. It's not the only element, it's the most powerful element. That is why it is emphasized so much. Now, the third and the fourth truths deal with the absolute, the deathless, the unconditioned. Those first two truths are concerned with the relative, the mortal sphere, the conditioned state. The important point is that there are truths which deal with man confined to the sphere of mortality. Mortality being a word which, apart from the mortality of the body, and any body will die, of course, any living body will die, whether it be a Buddha or not a Buddha, you see, it will die. But the mortality which encloses our mind and consciousness. Immortality is a realization in mind and consciousness only. And if, since immortality belongs to that realm, it belongs to the context of the immeasurable, the non-finite. If it is non-finite, it knows no birth and no death. It is birthless, deathless. It is not an entity. And that which is not the entity but is in actual realization, the totality, it has no beginning, no ending. It has activity which we may call prasidya, but it has no birth and no death. And it is there that immortality is made real for us here, if we realize this state which is the perfect enlightenment. So, the third truth which affirms positively that there is the extinction of dukkha. And the fourth truth, the way, the middle way as it is called, but as we saw the other day, in actuality the middle way is the transcendent way. There is no middle about it in any spatial or finite or limited sense. It is middle, perhaps in this sense, that it is the in-between successive pulses of creation in eternity. It is the in between successive pulses of creation in eternity. In that sense, it's a middle, but it is an inconceivable thing. You can't picture it. What do you mean by that which is between two successive pulses of creation in eternity? It is unpicturable altogether. It transcends, completely transcends space-time consciousness. You see? This word middle way, this term middle way, Majjhima Patipada, is a very difficult thing to understand. We can begin to understand it only when somehow or other we sense the nature of this pulsation of creation in eternity. not in a containing space, in a box called space. It's very difficult. So the fourth truth presents this magga, this way. And the way has its expression in our limited terms. Perfect understanding, perfect aspiration, perfect speech, perfect action, etc. But if any one of those items is perfect, all the bounds of finitude are out. In perfection there is no finitude, no limitation. You see? So the third and the fourth truths are transcendental truths. Very few scholars, mere scholars, however brilliant their brains may be, have ever truly seen that fact. The first and the second truths are relative truths. They lie in the sphere of the mortal and relative. The third and the fourth belong to the context of immortality, the context of non-finitude. Now, all that can be theory and is theory. So many words. Words attempting to portray ideas, concepts, which try to be more or less correspondence of the reality. You see, a description which we say is true means that what is said bears correct correspondence with the object or event or situation of which you are speaking. In a court of law, for instance, when you give evidence, you speak the truth, as we say. I saw this, that, and the other. I heard this, that, and the other. And what you say has to bear exact correspondence with what you actually saw. That sort of truth is truth in our relative sphere. But this sort of truth has a context which makes it extremely difficult to make the correspondence a perfect correspondence. We must never forget that. That is why scripture is interpreted by different people, the hundreds of millions of different people who follow a particular scripture. You see, in millions of ways, the mental construct which is formed in each person's mind is different from the mental construct in another person's mind. That is why he is a rash man who says, "Oh yes, I know the truth." He quotes chapter and verse and holds forth beautifully, but if he is well aware all the time that he really does not know, then he's a reasonably good man, on the way perhaps. Now, we'll stop there for a moment where the theory aspect is concerned. And subscribing to this theory means just membership. Now the practice, the discipleship. And the practice and the discipleship has its definite link with the membership part, the theory part, in terms of the way. This is something which you do now. And the treading of the way has two extremely important aspects. Actually, it is only one, but it is convenient to see it as two at the moment. One sees the truth, sees the meaning of perfect understanding, perfect aspiration, etc., etc. One strives to see it. When one has truly seen it, then you will discover that simultaneously it is being fulfilled right down at the concretest level of action. You see? Then that is real discipleship. The seeing and the doing are an identity. They are not separate. But they start as something separate, because we are like that. That is to say, we are limited. We are not yet capable of immediate perception in perfection. The perception grows and grows, and the understanding grows and grows. And as it grows, it is always associated with the capacity to do, to be it. And then that is the perfect discipleship as such. Now, in this practice, we have the 8 items: the perfect understanding, aspiration, speech, action, mode of living. Don't restrict it to livelihood. The perfect endeavor. Perhaps one of the most important points in connection with the perfect endeavor is the complete absence of personal ambition. I want to do this, to achieve this. No. It is transcendence itself. It is prajna itself, karuna itself, which is coming freely through you, the unresisting person who is cleaning himself out of the obstructions to the perfect wisdom and the transcendent compassion. You see? Then your endeavor is right endeavor. Also, therefore, your own brain, your own conscious mind as a whole, will be utterly free of particular ideas about what the perfect endeavor or the fruition, the nature of the fruition, what we call the goal, is like. It has to be free of those concepts, because all those concepts are limiting concepts. Then comes samasati, the perfect mindfulness, and samasamadhi, the perfect communion. Think of it in terms of the perfect communion rather than use the word concentration. Because the word concentration in practically all the old religious teachings of the past, in the practice of meditation or contemplative prayer, etc., does imply the exclusion of this, that, and the other. But the perfect communion is one in which there is no exclusiveness at all. Otherwise, how can it be the perfect communion? Because the perfect communion is not a thing which is finite, which is limited. It is infinite. It is like the Mahakaruna, the perfect compassion, this transcendent love which is utterly universal, or the Mahaprajna. You see? Now do realize that Samasati is the linchpin of the whole practice of the way. That is the real linchpin, this perfect mindfulness all the time. Don't forget that. And the mindfulness is really an activity which fills the day. The Buddha says quite straightforwardly, he goes to sleep perfectly mindful. He never comes to confusion or bewilderment in his sleep. It's an extraordinary statement. And you'll find that same statement in the Upanishads, not in what are called the principal Upanishads, but particularly in the Yoga Upanishads, which deal with the practice of the holy life. You see? You'll find it there, unequivocally stated in so many words, that in your sleep, you are completely awake. You are awake not merely in the physical sense, but in the transcendental sense. When the mind, when the psyche is completely purified and mind in its reality is functioning freely through you, there is no distinction between conscious mind and unconscious or subconscious mind. And in a strange way, this vigilance center never completely goes to sleep and loses control over the organism. This is one of the extraordinary things that happens. That is why they say the accomplished yogi, the siddha, never sleeps. His body sleeps. That is to say, his body is so completely relaxed and at ease that all the value of sleep is available to that body. The body gets recharged with energy and vitality. But it doesn't sleep in our sense of the term, because there is this free flow between the ordinary energies and living process of the body. There is a communication between that and transcendent energies of which we know nothing yet. At least I know nothing yet. See? Apart from the fact that this is what happens. All right. So one can never overstress the importance of mindfulness. And with that is associated the release of calm within the whole psychophysical organism. Samatha, calm, and the flowering out gradually of vipassana. First meaning, inward seeing, introspection. When the introspection is quite flawless, this has nothing to do with what is commonly called morbid introspection. It's nothing of that sort. This is seeing the fact, the truth of the withinness of your own wholeness in a mature state, maturity of the psyche, the mind particularly. That introspection, and that is the same as the flowering out of insight. Because when that power to introspect in the full sense, the organism which is yourself has come to fruition, because you see the whole truth of the microcosm which is yourself, your vision is clear and clear-sighted with respect to the macrocosm. This separation, this divorce between the conscious and the unconscious, between the self and the not-self is out. You see the significance of the middle way. Nothing very middle about it. It's a tremendous thing. It's a titanic task. All right. There is that other aspect which we mentioned the other day, the triple aspect of sila, samadhi, panya. Now, with respect to sila, we can apply this knowledge that the sila has to be absolute, complete, full, our harmlessness, our non-stealing, our freedom from indulging the sense faculties. That indulgence is transformed into the complete, the perfect, the right use of the senses. All the silas become cords of, all the senses become cords of communion then. They are not our enemies. This is one of the sad things that has crept into all the religions of the world where their conventional orthodox presentation is concerned. The senses are the betrayers, beware of the flesh and the devil. If you keep on bewaring the flesh and the devil, you will always be plagued with the flesh and the devil. You'll never get free of them. Why? Because they are me, myself. A very simple common sense reason. All right. So the sealers become perfect. And insofar as the sealers become perfect, they are present flawlessly. Your samadhi, your communion, becomes perfect because there is no obstruction to that communion. What obstructs is our ambivalence, our dualistic nature, the conflict therein, and the presence of the ambivalent virtue-vice situation. All that is out. There is the unification. That unification means the wholeness, the health, the holiness. And when that holiness is there, the samadhi is bound to be perfect. And if the sila and the samadhi are moving into that condition, growing into that condition of perfection, your panya, your insight, is just naturally there. You become the all-seeing one, the all-understanding one. And understanding faultlessly. Now you see why the great teachers were said to be omniscient. It's not that the whole of the encyclopedia was inside their brains, not at all. As I have said so often, they'd probably fail their O-levels if they were suddenly set the papers. Not that sort of burden of knowledge, acquired knowledge. But this functioning of pure intelligence, the unobstructed free intelligence. And that is the meaning of, or at least the principal meaning of the New Testament saying, not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. It's put in a material form, not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but this is its deep meaning. The function of intelligence within us, buddhi, of panya, intelligence in the sense of panya, prajna, or buddhi, is the ability to see the truth of whatsoever is there. To see it at once, to know it. That is intelligence. The other is conditioned perceiving, which the 4,000 millions of human beings on the earth exercise. Conditioned perception. But the unconditioned perception is a very different thing altogether. With those, in the actual practice then of the holy life, there are the four Brahma Viharas, the Metta, Karuna, Mudita and Upekha. So you see, when we sort of sit down and practice sending forth loving kindness, suffusing someone, the teacher, the friend, etc., etc., with loving kindness, what do we actually do? We go through a verbal ritual. That's all. It is not entirely impotent, but we are rather, out of our ignorance and a little bit of vanity and a little bit of self-conceit, you see, we pat ourselves on the back that we have done a good deed for the day. We have sent out loving kindness or compassion to so and so who's in suffering and so forth. There is a little effect, but oh my God, what a minute effect. And yet it can do, even that can do wonders sometimes. The real Brahma Vihara, the power of the Brahma Viharas, begins when you can freely enter the plane of infinite Akasha and Vijnana and transcend it. Then you are actually in touch with the archetypal transcendent energies. And you can let them loose. Remember, don't try to play with fire. And the entry into the jhana and the samapatis, that's all part of the actual discipleship in meditation, you see. Now, the theory part again. Vaya dhamma sankhara, sabbe sankhara. All sankharas are perishing, void of reality. And the three signs of being as they are presented, anicca, anatta, dukkha. And remember to translate anicca as relative rather than impermanent or permanent. Relative. The absolute is not the opposite of the relative. The relative means the world of duality and multiplicity. But when all multiplicity is wholly integrated and transcended in mind and consciousness, then the absolute is there, which is not the opposite of the relative. The relative contains permanence and impermanence. So don't look at anicca. You see, the literal meaning of anicca, the Sanskrit, is anitya. And nitya means eternal. The moment you have said eternal, you are no longer in the realm of the relative. There is nothing opposite to the eternal. I know people talk in terms of the eternal on the one hand and the temporal on the other. But the proper opposite of temporal, temporary, is everlasting, which means continuity through time. But the time consciousness and the consciousness which is eternity are quite different. Then there is the theory, in the theory part, there is the paticca samuppada. We'll deal with that tomorrow, perhaps. In which the key point, again, is tanha, and the next important key point is avidya, ignorance, as we say. To start with, ignorance of the theory. And the absolute which is posited there is sambodhi in the discipleship, the realization, the actualization. You see? So now, we have just a brief glimpse of theory and practice, of membership and discipleship in the full sense, more or less summarized there.